Welcome to Center Stage. My name is Mark Gordon. The new documentary, Love Thy Nature, looks at our relationship with Mother Earth. It takes us around the world on this journey where we see the beauty and the wonder that is nature and how we as a society with technology, we've become separate from nature. We're lucky enough to have with us in studio tonight, Sylvie Rokab. She is the director and producer of this beautifully shot film, and it's narrated by Liam Neeson. Sylvie, welcome to Center Stage. Tell me how you got involved with this project.
I think I've always been a nature lover, and I was lucky enough to grow up in Rio de Janeiro, which is a city embedded in the Mata Atlântica, which is the Atlantic forest. It's one of the most biodiverse places on the planet, even though most people don't know that. And so I had an amazing childhood because even though I was in the big city, my parents would take us to these amazing places and to the mountains, and we would go to beaches and explore waterfalls and go to these places that were just completely, it was total wilderness in some cases. And so I grew up loving nature. I think that nature was my background. It was my playground. It was my sense of wonder. And it was also my place of healing and comfort when I needed a friend. It was like nature was it for me in so many ways. And so eventually I became a filmmaker. And I think a big part of me becoming a filmmaker was because I was so fascinated by the natural world that it was about getting the camera out and playing, finding critters and just, you know, shooting whatever I could find in the natural world, as well as people. I mean, I've done social issue films and everything. It's a film that's meant to be both an environmental film and an inspiring film about celebrating our relationship with a natural world, because we are an extension of nature, because we are nature and we need nature. It's almost like I wanted to make a film that was an homage and invite people to the environmental conversation from a place of loving where we are, loving everything about the natural world, because we do live in an amazing planet. One of the reasons I chose the title Love Thy Nature is because it's got this double entendre. Because ultimately, when you're loving the nature outside of you, it also is the nature inside of us. You say, my nature is to be kind or whatever. It's like we have our own nature. And so they're two of the same. And there's work that needs to be done within ourselves to find ourselves finding moments in which we can relax, we can connect, we can communicate, we can ideally have a practice of good nutrition, of meditation, of inquiring within oneself, being present to, this is my thought right now. Why am I thinking that? You know, having that inner exploration, I think is critical to actually be a well-balanced human.
You traveled around the world to make the film, didn't you?
You could say that. We went to four countries, and so, you know, we went, well, I'm based in Los Angeles, but across the United States, we went from Florida to Alaska, and most of our city scenes were filmed in New York City, and, you know, here in California, in many places, Southern California, Northern California as well. Brazil, where I'm from, and so, of course, you know, the whole region of the Atlantic Forest, I did quite a bit of filming there, and we had great teams of people there, too. And Namibia for the African scenes, and I wanted to have beautiful, big, exotic, mammals
great,
on the film.
Great images of animals, which leads me to this next topic, is that this notion that animals don't have feelings.
Right.
One of my favorite philosophers, Descartes, he looked at that. It's funny. I never knew this, but he looked at animals, and when he got down to the lowly clam, he said, no. A clam cannot have feelings.
Therefore.
Well, have you ever talked to a clam, Renee? Come on. But
there's that, and there's also concluding that if a clam doesn't have feelings, then chimpanzees or dogs don't either.
Yeah, how do you glom it?
Putting everybody in the same category of animals.
Well, it's interesting because I think people personify animals. You know, they look at animals and they kind of put their own feelings in the animal, but there's something about it. I mean, my cat, you know, that thing, she waits for me when I come home and she's chatty and she's all over the place. I can't get any work when she's there because she wants that attention.
Yeah.
And so there.
What is that? Right?
Yeah. What is that?
Right.
I mean, I'd be interested to go inside her brain and find out really what makes her tick.
Or her heart.
Well, yeah, her heart, because she sure knows how to manipulate me. And I mean, you look
she's
at
she's got animal, away with you. Huh?
Well, yeah, you look at animals and you know they feel something, because when you see the little dog that's dressed up in some outfit because it's raining, you're going, dog doesn't like that. First of all, dog's got fur. Dog digs the rain. But you got it dressed up in some little outfit. Yeah. It's embarrassing.
I know. It's so funny. And it's like, it's almost like, okay, we're waiting for science to prove to us that animals have feelings. Whatever. Maybe science will prove that in the year 2500 or 3000. Who knows, right? If it's ever going to be proven. But the question is, you just need to look at the face of a dog who's staring at you, asking you for love. It's like, what is that? I mean, it's not, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, it's just, there's something about emotional connection that you pick it up.
You bring up the stats in the film where one were 99% related to the chimpanzee.
Right.
And then 25% of our genes are within trees.
Right.
Which I've never heard that before.
Right. It was the first time I had heard it also. But it kind of makes sense, because when you think of it, every molecule of our body or the elements that compose our body are the same elements that are on the planet and that even are on the moon. And so we do have this connection to the place that we live in. I think it's also about, there's no doubt that there's a lot of beauty, and, you know, the technologies that we have today are extraordinary. The fact that we can connect with somebody, you know, across the planet, or that we can, you know, communicate with people we haven't communicated with since childhood, or the medical discoveries. And so technology is something that it's really a beautiful thing, but we can't dive into the technological world to the point in which being in cyber world means that we forget who we really are.
Well, even that relationship, you bring it up in the film, where we breathe out CO2,
mm-hmm.
trees breathe that in.
Right.
And they give us in return oxygen.
It's a symbiosis. It's a total symbiosis. Most of us don't even realize it. We need everything about nature for our, you know, nutrition, for our hydration. We need nature, especially as children, but also as adults. We need to have a sense of wonder and a sense of meaning. And anybody, even people who are like city folks, if you're able to drag them into the natural world and go to a place that's going to take their breath away, it's like there's something that happens with being in contact with pure wilderness that just cracks our heart open and makes us realize it's like we're so small. But at the same time, because we're so small and we belong to something so much bigger than ourselves, somehow there's this magical thing that happens in our neurons or in our hearts that makes us come alive. I mean, I don't know anybody that I've been able to drag into the wilderness who hasn't had this experience. It's just wired in us.
You do this interesting thing about a timeline.
Earth in a year. If you were to compress the life of Earth into 1 year, the 4.5 billion years of Earth's evolution, of Earth's history, and we compress it into 1 year, all these groups of species and ecosystems that showed up at different times through this year, and Homo sapiens, you and I, our species, showed up 23 minutes ago. And our civilization, as we know it, the last 200 years, the way that we think, the way that we communicate, the way that we have our media and our technologies, the last 200 years are 1 second of this entire year of planet's evolution. And here we are trying to figure it all out on our own, when we can realize that if we were to look at the workings of nature throughout this entire year, there's a universe of learning that we haven't even tackled.
If we were just to take this technology and apply it towards renewables, to solar and wind power, we could really be at the forefront. If we're concerned about clean air and clean water, you can't have it both ways. You can't be a coal and oil-based economy and yet have clean air and clean water.
We have the capacity of moving forward We don't need to be digging up old stuff from down below. The cost of solar plants, basically, if you were to look at how costly solar plants have been in the last 10 or 20 years, I mean, the cost has been decreasing dramatically to the point where in certain areas there's production of solar energy that's actually cheaper than coal. Of course, it's not across all countries across the world, but it's slowly, gradually getting there. And so if the government, actually all governments from all the countries, because all the countries are in this, we're all in this together,
right,
regardless where we come from, where we live. But if all the governments made the effort to actually subsidize new sustainable energies, we're already there. I mean, we know the cost of solar panel, of solar energy is actually becoming gradually cheaper than even coal. It's almost like we're having a bit of a dichotomy between the old and the modern. What was the old way of doing things and what is a jump in our history forward into doing something that is both profitable and sustainable. I mean, there's no reason why we can't go there. Economically, it would make tremendous sense.
There's always been this, I think, this notion where man wants to dominate and control nature. 20 years ago, they introduced genetically modified organisms in food.
It's a very dangerous area. And let me just say to begin with that I understand the desire. As humans, we have this amazing brain and an amazing capacity for neurological exploration and wanting to discover things. I think that there's nothing wrong with attempting new technologies and discovering things. But this is an area that's extremely dangerous because the moment in which you're actually creating a genetically modified trees and you're planting this tree and these trees, all of the trees that are genetically modified in an ecosystem that's been around for millions of years, which is the case of what's happening in the Atlantic forests in Brazil. Their genetically modified trees are being planted there.
Is that the palm trees?
Well,
like for palm oil?
Some of them are eucalyptus trees that basically they plant those trees so that the bugs don't want to eat the trees. And so, of course, it disrupts the whole ecosystems because if the bugs get weak, then the frogs that eat the bugs are not there. And then the predators that eat the frogs. I mean, it's like a ripple effect. And so my point is that it's one thing to be in a lab and do experiments, scientific experiments, that's very controlled, and then as time goes by to explore what are the consequences in a very controlled environment. But when you're actually modifying, genetically modifying, first of all, our food chain, we don't know. This genetically modified industries are very young.
The scary thing about GMOs is it destroys biodiversity. The other thing that's kind of scary is that you're going to have a few agrochemical companies mm-hmm. that own seeds, that own all the food.
We're losing control of our health. If this ultimately ends up happening, it's like we're being fed genetically modified organisms, fruits or vegetables, whatever, that we don't know in the long haul what are the consequences
right.
of this. We're talking about an apple and we're talking about a field. But now imagine as these genetically modified organisms now start taking over entire forests or ecosystems. Are we really at a place, Homo sapiens? Are you really Homo sapiens at a place in which you can completely modify planet Earth? We don't have planet B. You know, so if we mess this
oh, no,
one
no, no.
up.
We're going to go to Mars.
You know what I mean?
That's the plan.
Well,
we're going to colonize
within
Mars.
10, 15, 20 years? Or, I mean, you know.
Whoever knows how long it takes to get there.
It's like, goodness gracious, I want to see some forests and oceans and ecosystems and deserts. And I want to see, like, the jaguar as much as I want to see the snakes and the scorpions and all of these parts, bacteria and fungi, completely alive and blossoming on another planet before I would decide to send my kids over there. Not that I have kids, but it's like we're not ready to move. And even if we were, if we're not able to take care of our planet home, of our home planet, you know, what are we going to trash another planet and then another planet and then another planet? And that's what I think I get really excited about, is to get people to realize we are capable of living in this planet in a way that's healthy for us, that's prosperous, economically speaking, for everybody, because if you really think of biomimicry and the biological revolution, as Dana explains it on the film, we can transform our industries like that because the potential is extraordinary. And it's like you can transform your economic system, you can transform our political and social systems. I mean, it's obviously a very involved conversation to be able to say it within an hour, but there is an opportunity, economically speaking, that right now we can see with the solar panels and the wind panels and the architecture that's being built with highly efficient buildings and cars that are actually being run with batteries and all of those things that are coming up right now. They're incredibly exciting. And so really, to fulfill our potential as Homo sapiens sapiens, the species that knows that it knows, what better way than actually to be fully alive and the planet that we were given by Mother Nature and make it work. We can do this. So we all understand this conversation that is all about wanting the best for ourselves and for the rest of the world and for our kids, especially. They're the ones who are going to come next and they're going to be inheriting what's here today. And so, I mean, I don't know anybody, if you were to say to them, what would you like, you know, how would you like your kid's life? What would you like your kid's life to be like or your grandkid's life? I mean, tell me if that's not a unifying thing where everybody would say, of course I want my kid's life and my grandkid's life and their kid's life to be really healthy and happy and prosperous. It's a formula that if people take that into consideration, there's no debate here.
Look at young people. Look at kids. Mm-hmm. Kids are automatically concerned about the environment. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember when I was in elementary school, I did a recycling drive.
Oh, cool.
and there's that inner sense that kids have, right?
Yeah.
And then somehow...
And they want to look at critters.
Yeah, we look at critters and then we grow up and we kind of get away from that. I mean, there's an interesting stat in the film how the average child spends 8 hours a day looking at media, looking at their computer,
in
playing games.
Mm-hmm.
In the U.S.
Right.
And I mean, when I was a kid, well, we didn't have like the proliferation of computers. So we were outside. We loved being outside. We didn't want to come back in.
I know.
Because
it's like,
there was
just another 15 minutes.
There were all kinds of things that we could do, but,
right.
but that has really changed.
I do think that kids take after their parents. I don't say that to criticize anybody. I mean, I myself struggle sometimes because I might be spending way too much time on the computer. But, you know, because we are in this world of technology that kind of sucks us in and, you know, the media and advertisers, and it's like there's all of this energy that's trying to get our attention. But it's really about making sure that we make the time for ourselves and for our kids. And the making the time every day, I usually tell people, get your exercise outdoors or go to a neighborhood park. I mean, I have this routine.
Do you see how excited you get?
I get really excited.
Has it always been like that for you?
It has.
I mean, is that also, I mean, you talk in the film about how being in touch with nature, it makes kids more creative.
Oh, yeah. They have less ADD symptoms diminish. There's a sense of connectedness. They become more peaceful. They explore things that they're not able to explore when they're in a computer. I mean, I know some of the stuff that I'm saying is probably super obvious, but when you think of ourselves as adults, but thinking as a child, right? Let's say you're like a 2 or 3 or 4 year old. They are wired by nature to be going outside and exploring. What happens if I turn this rock over and there might be a little critter underneath it? And it's like, oops, there's a little frog that just jumped on my face, or whatever it might be, just walking by a trail or touching water. I know we filmed this little toddler and her dad was holding her and he was just balancing on a rock on a river. And this little toddler was like just doing this little game of trying to find which leaves could she pick from the water. I mean, it's such an easy little game, but for a toddler, that's part of becoming human. That's part of like growing up and discovering her world. And the sensations, and how does water feel versus sand, and, you know, creating a sand castle. And I mean, the universe of possibilities of discovering our world. And even for us adults, when I do take my break and I go on a walk or whatever, recently, I mean, we're here in Southern California. We've been gifted with all of this water that's been coming down. Of course, certain communities had floods, and I'm really sorry for the folks who have had trouble in that way. But for us as a state, it's like we needed a lot of water, and it's finally come down. Now, I was going down a little path near my house where there's a little creek, and now the creek is actually running. And as I was getting closer to the creek, and it was the end of the day, and I could hear the little frogs like going, brack, brack. And then they started little by little. Within 5 minutes, there was a symphony. And I remember just like feeling like in bliss. All of those hours of like digital world and emails and phone calls and stress and concerns over deadlines and all of that just dissolved into the symphony of frogs. And of course, just explaining it, it's nothing like the experience, but it was just so beautiful. I felt like it was a symphony of the world. And I remember feeling like I got all teared up because it's like, my goodness, I forget how amazing this is. And everybody deserves to have that. And we can have that on a daily basis, even if it's 10 or 15 minutes. But some folks go throughout the year and another year and another year or a decade, and they don't even realize that they have the opportunity to go to, if it's not a neighborhood park, maybe a state park or a national park. You know, we just had the centennial of the national parks system with all of these magnificent places around this country. And of course, around the world, there are many magnificent places that are there for us to explore and to reconnect and recharge and come alive again.
The thesis of the film is looking at the interconnectedness of Homo sapien with nature. But there's so many different layers of your film. Tell me about that process and how you went to incorporate, because you do cover everything that kind of encapsulates what it means to be a part of nature and then be disconnected from that.
It's funny, the process of making the film, it's like at the very beginning I had this idea that I wanted to make a film that, again, was an homage of our relationship with nature. And then it's kind of like, for me, it comes as scenes. I don't know what the storyline or the script might be yet, but I start visualizing, envisioning certain scenes. And so the scene that's on the film, and it's actually also on the trailer that's online on lovethynature.com, that scene of the kids playing video games, and then it becomes increasingly fast-paced and it becomes manic, and then the little girl from the video game just starts falling and there's a scream, and that we're like in Central Station in New York City, and boom, this kid presses a button and kills the little cowboy on the video game. The cowboy falls, there's an explosion, and there's a forest catching fire. And then we have footsteps for a very long dissolve. There are footsteps of humans walking on fire, basically. And you know, that scene was in my mind for years. And, you know, as I was working through the process of writing the script and all of that, you know, there were several scenes like that, that I knew those scenes were symbolic of, you know, for instance, the two faces, the black woman and the white guy. And as she takes an in-breath, he takes an out-breath. And that was the dance of meditation. And that was actually the longest scene, you know, shot of the film. You know, if you're listening out there, it's a painful 30-second long shot. I say that jokingly because it's almost like, you know, somebody told me you have to cut the scene shorter, you know, as from an editing standpoint. And I said, no, that scene is an opportunity for people to experience what meditation feels like, where you have all of these, you know, different feelings about a shot, about, you know, being present in the present moment. But so the process for me is very visual. It's very musical in a sense. And then the storyline gets written by, you know, wanting to follow what is the spine of the story, which is, you know, the thesis statement of the beginning of the film is that we can only make it as a species on this planet if we reconnect with nature. And then having Liam Neeson's voice, his character, which is Sapiens, Homo Sapiens, going through the journey of being very cynical and defensive and, you know, tough at the beginning of the film, and going through this journey of awakening to the magnificence of his relationship with nature.
What did you learn about the process of making film and yourself?
I learned that it takes a lot of patience.
Really?
I've done several films, independent films, and but none of them might have had the level of involvement and personal passion that this one did. I also worked with television. I mean, I've started doing, you know, cinematography camera work for the Travel Channel, and worked on some projects for PBS, and directed and shot and edited and wrote a series for Discovery Health called House of Babies, which was about natural childbirth. So I started working on this film already with a background, a solid background of filmmaking, but with a full realization that that was the film that was meant to be, probably, you know, I don't know if it's my biggest gift to the world, but it's definitely the gift that I've always wanted to give. Growing up in Brazil and just completely falling in love with nature and finding nature to be my best friend, my place of wonder and discovery, and my place of joy and place of connectedness with animals and with other kids, and realizing the heartbreak I went through when I've discovered the level at which we're destroying nature. My heart kept breaking into pieces over and over and over again, and it still does. But I got that sense and that realization that if people got nature, if people connected with nature at the level in which I did, we as a civilization would never allow this to happen. I think what I learned about myself is that I have a ton of perseverance and a ton of passion on this issue. I mean, I knew that to begin with, but now I know that much more so.
You mentioned wonder and discovery.
Yeah.
It almost seems like that's a newness for you. So will you approach the next project with the same kind of wonder and discovery?
I mean, that's a great question, and it's a really tricky one to answer. I mean, I certainly, now that I know how audience members are feeling moved, I'm getting to realize the depth at which we have a deficit of wonder, a deficit of real open-hearted experiences. And I think that people might not realize it, but there's something about inspiring folks through a film that's deeply moving and inspiring that actually just opens them up. When people come to me after screenings and they say the different ways that the film has moved them, I get moved by them being moved. I remember there was this couple, they came with their three kids, so it was a family of five. He was a big guy. He wanted to talk with me, and during Q&A or after Q&A, I'm all there, and I wait until everybody asks their questions. And he was trembling, and he actually couldn't ask his question because he was so moved. So his wife ended up talking about how the film had impacted them and how they realized that they really wanted to start taking their family outdoors like they used to, like years ago.
I think if we really started honoring that, we would find a deeper sense of a relationship with ourselves, our higher power, whatever that is to you.
Right.
And also to others, and
yeah,
and almost that sense of generosity that we would bestow upon others and to ourselves by
totally
by reconnecting.
That's the irony of it, right, Mark? That it's like when you find yourself connecting more deeply with nature, you ultimately end up connecting more deeply to yourself and to those around you. I mean, it's inevitable, because there's this thing that happens where our blood pressure comes down and all of a sudden our senses come alive, because when we're in nature, we're feeling, whether it's cold or it's hot or it's you're listening to the wind, or you might be hearing birds, or you might get a little jitter when you see a critter that's not quite your favorite critter. And it's like all of those things come alive, and there's something that happens that brings us back to who we're meant to be, which is this creature that has all these senses and that is alive and a social creature. I mean, we're incredibly social. A lot of my meetings nowadays, I invite people to join me at a park or at a beach. It is amusing because it's not our way of doing things, right? When I'm calling somebody and say, hey, I have an important issue I want to talk to you about. There's, you know, this idea, this project, there's something I would love to cross-pollinate, partner up, or whatever. The best place to have this conversation is outside. And it's inevitable that creativity flows and there's a deeper connection with this person. And it's pretty magical. I always tell people, don't try to raise money only behind your computer if that's what you're doing. Or don't try to create an amazing project by texting somebody. We are a social being. We need to have that connection where we're looking at each other's eyes, where we are deeply connecting. And ultimately, we want to know, what are the true motivations? Why are you thinking that idea? What's in your heart to do? All of a sudden, we go a notch deeper, and then we become more real, more authentic. Nature provides all of these opportunities for us, and we're disconnecting from nature makes us disconnect from each other, and it makes us disconnect from ourselves. And it's dangerous. I mean, we need to find a way to bring it back into our lives.
Just a reminder, you can hear Center Stage every Tuesday night right here on KXLU Los Angeles, 88.9 FM. We're also streaming the show online at kxlu.com. If you have any questions or comments about the program, love to hear from you. You can send me an email, and my address is mark@stageandscreen.com. Until next time, this is Mark Gordon, and I'll see you Center Stage.